Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show brought to you on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. We wish everyone well on this Martin Luther King Day. I hope you're enjoying a day off, and we wish good luck to President Obama, who was inaugurated yesterday for his second term, and as you just heard on WPKN, you heard his take the oath of office again this afternoon, and there'll be great festivities in Washington celebrating the commencement of his second term. With me in the studio is In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe. And also handling the board today is Shell Tarrant with her usual panache. Thank you very much for being here, Shell. And in today's show, we're going to focus on matters close to home. What are the big issues facing Connecticut General Assembly as it begins its legislative work for 2013? To help us understand what's likely to come up and how it might affect you, we're pleased to be joined by State Representative Fred Camillo, who represents the 151st Assembly District in Greenwich. Representative Camillo, who is a Republican, is beginning his third term in the Assembly. Representative Camillo, can you hear me now?
Yes, Ken, good afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. What do you see as the most critical issues that the Connecticut's General Assembly will have to deal with this year?
Well, you know, Ken, it's since I've been up there the last 4 years, it's been about jobs and promoting commerce in the state. That hasn't changed. Excuse me. In some respects, it's actually become even more of a focus. But also this year, as many people know, due to the horrific event that took place in Newtown, we're also going to be debating a lot of different, various gun bills. Some not so good, some that are needed, but certainly there's a mix there for everybody to weigh in on, that's for sure.
And of course, the budget will be continuing to be a problem.
Yeah, we just plugged a hole for about $415 million on December 19th for the current fiscal year. But going forward, the upcoming one and the next out year, we're both seeing reports of deficits in excess of $1 billion each year.
And that's brought out of spending is roughly $20 billion in Connecticut, something like that?
Roughly, yes.
Okay, so you're talking about right now the deficit is relatively small in comparison to the total spending, especially when you look at the federal government, Representative Camillo, which spends about $2 for every dollar it takes in. Our deficits, we seem like we're pretty frugal in Connecticut by comparison. But
I guess the difference is we don't print money.
Exactly. They just keep printing it, and they just are lending it out to banks at 0%, and as long as we're the world's reserve currency, it's no problem. And another issue that's very important to many of our listeners is the GMO labeling legislation. Now, can you tell us how has that fared in the past, and is it likely to get serious consideration this year?
Yes, yeah, that's a great question to ask. I appreciate you bringing that up. I'm a member of the GMO caucus up there, and it's a caucus of Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, who just want the people of the state to have a right to know what it is they're eating. We're not saying whether genetically modified organisms are bad or good. We all have our thoughts on it, but certainly we're not even saying that. We're not doing what over 50 other countries have done, which is ban them. We're just saying let's label them. Of course, companies like Monsanto are going to fight that. We almost had a bill last year, which would have made us the first in the country, but that got stalled. But we're you know, I don't. We said at the beginning this was not going to be an easy one, and we're certainly prepared to take on that fight and to keep on it until eventually people know what it is they're eating. And they, just so you know, it's not just resistance here in the state, but it's also, you know, the federal government doesn't help out on this at all. So it's a long shot, but we're certainly going to keep on it. And I predict, as good as I can predict these things, that sometime in the future, all the states will definitely have these labels on them. But, you know, it takes, like everything else, it takes one or two states to start it. And I know California just was defeated out there, the initiative to label them, the GMOs. But, you know, people have to remember there were millions and millions and millions of dollars spent by companies like Monsanto on lobbyists.
As with your support for it as a Republican, it shows that it does have strong bipartisan support in Connecticut. Where does the opposition come from? It seems like everybody should support it.
You would think so. We heard last year, believe it or not, we were told, well, they had a constitutional question about it. And when we pressed them, some of the people up there at the Capitol, what the constitutional question was, it came back to us that the question was Monsanto's right, a company like Monsanto, not just Monsanto alone, but a company's right to remain silent versus the public's right to know.
Right. This seems like a pretty far stretch. I mean,
oh, really? I mean, I was a small businessman. I know if I ever told my customers they wanted to know what type of service I was providing or how I'm doing it, and I said, I have a right to remain silent, they would, I would be out of work.
That's pretty crazy. Now, you said you don't get much support on that issue from the federal government. People probably would think that a Democratic president would be a very strong supporter of GMO labeling, but no?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the president just reappointed a man who was actually had a big job at Monsanto.
Is that right? Now, that carries along a bipartisan tradition, because the original decision not to regulate the GMOs was made by President Bush Sr., and he appointed Monsanto people to his government. So
yeah, no, that's pretty much continued. And again, there are some people who are reasonable who would say there's no threat to it, to these genetically modified organisms. I would differ on that, but I'm certainly would leave that up to people. And that's what the labeling does. It is going to allow people to make their own decisions. And we heard, well, you know, they're not, and this is exactly what we heard, well, you know, people aren't going to take the time to research it. And we said, well, that's fine. That's up to them. But give them the opportunity to know when they're going to a store, just like they do when they go to the deli to get a soda, you're going to look to see if it's a Diet Coke or a regular Coke. This is the same thing.
It seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do. So we're going to watch that issue here at WPKN carefully this year. And the first issue you raised was jobs, which we talk a lot about on our show In Context. There aren't enough jobs, and the jobs that we have pay too little money, especially to keep up with the cost of living in Connecticut. What can state government do to help in the job situation?
Well, first and foremost, to get out of the way sometimes. I mean, we've been ranked, when I got up there 4 years ago, we were ranked anywhere from 38th to 50th. Now we're regularly ranked at number 50 by several different organizations.
In terms of what?
Business friendliness, competitiveness. And that encompasses a lot of things. First and foremost, your listeners may say, well, you know, he's a Republican. Of course he's going to say the taxes are too high. Well, that's a fact. It's not something I'm making up. That's a fact. There are other issues that would also play into it. The cost of living, it's very, very high here. And if you look at it, Connecticut is strategically located between Boston and New York. It has a very educated populace here. The geography is beautiful. We have waterfront, but we also have countryside. So there's a lot of things. You would think there's nothing stopping us from being number one. But if we've lost. We used to have a huge advantage over New York State because their taxes were way higher. And, of course, they have county government, which we disbanded in 1960. But, unfortunately, we've kind of given away a lot of our advantage. And I know Governor Malloy has done, I think, a good job to go out and really try and bring business back to the state. Having been a member of the Commerce Committee, I worked with his administration to do that. He started something called the First Five program, and that's, you know, trying to lure companies here with tax incentives. And
I believe that's worked. It's been very costly, and I would argue that if we would lower our costs of doing business here, not throwing out regulations, but certainly making them more reasonable and lowering the cost of doing business here, you wouldn't need to have spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to get companies to locate to relocate here. So I think he's got the right idea, and he's certainly been aggressive. The NBC deal in Connecticut, in Stamford, Connecticut, was a very good one. I'd like to see more along the lines of a deal like that. The Jackson Labs, I did vote for that one, and I know a lot of people criticized it.
Could you talk a little bit more, but people are not familiar with
Jackson Labs? Jackson Labs is a bioscience company that we were in competition with other states to bring here to Connecticut. We ended up getting them to genomic research. We ended up spending $300 million to bring them here with, you know, tax incentives, and we were criticized because it's only supposed to bring in about 300 jobs. That's not the whole picture. If that was the only case, you know, the only statistic we had to go on, then in fact I would have voted against it. There were other reasons I voted for it, and I think the governor worked very hard to address these concerns, and that was things like going forward, you know, is it just the 300 jobs? No, there were other jobs, spin-off jobs to come from that. We also, quite a few of us, expressed concern about the state always spending money on these companies to be here. But if they hit a home run, they had a great invention that made them a lot of money, the state never got anything from it. Under this agreement, we're a partner with them, and then from years 10 through 20, anything over $10 million, we're a 50% partner. So if you get a situation like what happened in New York with the company Remicade, they hit a grand slam with one of their products, and they made so much money they kicked back to the New York State Treasury $3 billion. And, you know, Connecticut has to start looking beyond the financial services industry, which is what Fairfield County is all about. And I know we in Fairfield County always complain, rightfully so, that we fund the rest of the state. Well, here's something that will allow the state to diversify a little bit, and I think the governor's really tried to make a sort of a Northeast research triangle to rival that of down there in North Carolina with Farmington, New Haven, and Storrs. So I think he's on the right track with that. Certainly the Republicans' concern about, you know, throwing money at these companies and not having any ability to see if they produced, in fact, the jobs they said they were. Well, we put forth a bill that the governor signed last year that actually does that now. So we, after a year, we revisit it and see, have they produced the jobs? Have they, you know, invested here in the state? And so when you look at all these things, I think we're going in the right direction, but it's not going to be done overnight.
Well, of course, the growth of the economy impacts Connecticut's budget, its budget deficit. What drives the budget here? In the federal level, it's war spending, and it's medical care spending, and it's Social Security. Those three items count for well over half federal spending. Are there similar items that drive state spending?
Yes. Yeah, in short, yes.
What is it?
The same things you just mentioned.
Except for the war. You got, what, Medicaid?
We don't have, yeah, the entitlement spending, the spending. We also, a lot of people don't understand is state employees have a very good health, service for their benefits. It's called the Cadillac plan. Well, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are former state workers who get their benefits for free. That's very costly. So we have to do a better job at reforming that going forward, because certainly we just can't sustain it.
And you're stuck in a system that you don't have any control over the overall costs of it.
We don't, and that's the problem. Even a lot of town governments, they have fixed costs built into their budget. So it's, you know, easy for us to say, let's, you know, have zero-based budgeting. I love that. Governor Jimmy Carter did that, of all people, in Georgia in the early 1970s. But, the problem with that is you have these contracts with unions, and there's already you have to fund increases, and it gets more and more expensive. Here in Connecticut, we're a state of 3.5 million people, and we have about 54,000 state employees. But we have many, many more that are on pensions and having their medical benefits paid for. So it gets very, very costly. We have to be smarter going forward. And I think the governor did start to address that. The House Republicans and the Senate Republicans have been pushing for that. At least the 4 years I've been up there, that they've made that a real priority, and it's something that we all do in our own personal lives. It's something that small businesses do, and it's something really that the state governments have to, because you can't sustain it anymore. It's unsustainable.
And before we let you go, we're speaking with Representative Fred Camillo. The name of the show is In Context. He represents the 151st Assembly District in Greenwich. And we're talking to him about the important issues that are going to be coming up before our Connecticut legislature this year. And one item that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I want to talk about it before you go, it was gun control. Of course, there was a horrible tragedy in Newtown, and so many, 26 people were killed. It's going to be considered this year by the legislature. What kind of legislation looks like it's going to be introduced?
Well, there's several bills. There's some which I call that are really knee-jerk reactionary bills that will do more harm than good. There was one bill that says I think it was Senator Meyer put a bill in that all guns should have no more than one clip at a time, and that's just silly. And there's a bill about publishing the names of all gun owners, and that would have the unintended consequence of really spiking gun ownership if that was the intent of this, to drive it down, because you wouldn't want to be on a list where somebody who is a criminal is looking at it and they decide, Ken doesn't have a gun, but his neighbors do. Guess whose house
that's gonna,
would
right.
be the target?
Right.
I mean, that would be, that's kind of silly.
That would be less effective. Having the gun would probably be more effective than that sign I have in front. Was it the ADT sign?
Well, I mean, we do know that that all criminals, the moment they see the ADT sign, are repelled by it. It's like garlic to vampires.
Marshad, who's just joined us in context.
That's right, Marshad.
What about, New York has just passed a law, right, which relates to assault rifles and to, I think, the capacity of clips that you're allowed to use in a rifle.
Right.
Will legislation like that be considered this year?
Yes, that will, and that I think you'll get more support. Certainly, I have been getting a lot of constituents and friends urging me not to do to vote for something like that. But as I tell everybody, you got to come to the table with something. And certainly, I would be very skeptical of something that maybe was retroactive, because again, the people, I know people have guns like that. That there is as law-abiding as anybody, and they don't commit crimes, and they, use them for, they go skeet shooting, and they do a lot of things with them, and some of them have them for protection. But going forward, I think you have to come to the table with something, and I don't think that really is going to affect anybody, banning, 30-round clips. This day and age, I don't know if we really need that anymore. There's one that one of the bills would tax the ammunition. I think that's not a good thing. That's not going to do anything. It wouldn't stop anybody who wants to commit a crime, saying that they're going to have to pay a few more dollars. Plus, that would really hit at the guys who are really going to shoot at the range. I mean, why would you want to keep penalizing people who have not done anything wrong and will not do anything wrong?
Right.
Well, and that's actually one of the reasons why I read not that long ago that statistically private gun owners have fewer incidences of accidentally hitting innocent bystanders than police officers do, because they shoot so often, because they have so much time familiarization, whereas police officers only, like the military, are only required to qualify once, maybe twice a year, civilians shoot a lot more. And if you tax it, it's not going to discourage people from actually practicing with the firearms they own, it would seem like to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't seen that, but certainly the unintended consequences of something like that would be something you have to be very, very careful of. I mean, going forward, I just try to tell people on both sides of this debate, you want to do something that's actually going to be productive and would make our public buildings safer. And a lot of that certainly has to do with mental health. A lot of that has to do with technology. There are some things out there that I've been meeting with security experts and local law enforcement officials, and they've given us some great ideas. So, if you combine something, you could come out, in a totality, you could come out with something that's good. You're never going to eliminate 100% the risk of something like this happening. Somebody wants to do something like that, it's really hard to stop them. But what you can do is you can make it much more difficult. And I tell people, going forward, we're probably going to have a ban on those high-capacity magazines. And that's fine. And I think, 30, 40 years from now, you'll see the fruits of that. But you're not going to see anything right away. And I urge people not to get a false sense of security if and when a ban is passed on that, because it's not. There's just too many out there right now. So what you want to do is you want to make sure going forward you have good policies in place, and that you also have an environment where it's as protective of innocent people as possible.
Well, we're going to have to watch that issue as well as the others very carefully, see what the legislature does this year. And I thank you very much, State Representative Fred Camillo, for joining us on Context, and hope to talk to you again.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I look forward to it.
Take care now.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Thank you very much.
Bye, Mark. Take care. Bye, Ken.
Why don't we take a music break now, and we'll come back in a few minutes and take your calls on, see what you think about some of these issues like gun control and the other issues that we discussed with Representative Camillo. So, Shel, why don't we put on some traveling music here, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to In Context. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We stream live at WPKN.org. In Context of WPKN's live public affairs call-in show is on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when our general manager, Steve, makes a report to the listeners. In the first segment of the show, we talked with Assemblyman Fred Camillo about some of the important issues that are going to be faced by the Connecticut's General Assembly during this year. And among the important issues is gun control, brought in, of course, by the terrible tragedy that occurred in December in Newtown, Connecticut, the Sandy Hook School, where 26 people, mainly children, were killed in a violent rampage. And we'd like to take your calls, hear what you think about gun control or any of the other issues, our budget, the question of out-control health care spending, the job situation, your opinion on anything. This is a chance for you to sound off on what you think is the biggest problem, what do you think should be done. So whether it's gun control or any other issue, please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with Marchand McDermott Rowe. And behind the board handling our technical stuff today is Shell Tarrant. And so give us a ring at that number, and we'll discuss what's on your mind. To get off with the gun control issue, I think Marchand McDermott Rowe is our military affairs commentator, and he knows quite a bit about weaponry. Could you talk a little about the type of weapon that's was used in the killings in Newtown? I believe it was called a Bushmaster, but it's generically something called an AR-15, AR standing for assault rifle. From what I understand, there are a couple million of them out there. Could you describe this particular rifle?
Absolutely. For any of our listeners who might have seen the movie Black Hawk Down, it's the iconic U.S. Army assault weapon of, I guess, up until the mid 2005, when they really started moving heavily to the M4. It's a rather clunky assault rifle that was used by the U.S. Army from Vietnam, roughly. There were some variants of it, but really from Vietnam up into the mid 2005 or so, 2006, when they really started to move heavily into the M4.
I see the M4 is, which is used today, is basically just a cut down version of the M16, as I understand it.
It is. It's a much smaller version. It's a shortened barrel. It's a collapsible buttstock, so it allows you to actually more or less shape it to your individual arm length. It's, in my opinion, more practical weapon than the M16, which is the same as the AR-15. The only difference, and I think this is what a lot of people don't necessarily understand, when they think assault rifle, they think of a guy walking in with a machine gun just like, bah, 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 bah. But the difference is the AR-15 is not fully automatic. It has two settings, safe and semi-auto, single shot. That's it.
In the military, you can put single shot, or you could do it in bursts,
Bursts of three.
Or fully automatic, where as long as you hold down the trigger, bullets keep coming out.
It depends on the version. What the U.S. Army uses just has bursts and semi-auto, but there were versions made during Vietnam that were fully auto.
Fully auto, but it's so inaccurate, I guess.
It's so utterly inaccurate. What a lot of people don't understand when they think of assault rifles, and usually you get this from people who aren't firearm owners, and I'm not saying this to knock on non-firearm owners. I mean, it's kind of like if you don't own a car, you shouldn't be expected to know a lot about how cars work. I don't expect people to know this, but when you talk about a semi-automatic, quote-unquote, assault rifle, really all it is it's a weapon that looks frightening. It's a weapon that looks like a military-grade weapon, but in reality it's probably actually no more lethal than a shotgun is. So,
well, the key thing is it's the civilian version of this gun, the one that's legal, is a single shot gun. So what characterizes it from a technical point of view is it's self-loading. Every time you shoot, then another round is loaded, so you can shoot again without having to pull back a bolt or do anything,
exactly.
Right? But that can be said of many other types of weapons.
Well, that's what I was just about to say too, is that almost every pistol, with the exception of revolvers, does that. It's their self-loading. But self-loading, again, I mean, if somebody's determined to go on a mass killing spree, they don't need a self-loading weapon. And I think this is what a lot of people fail to understand. A lot of people, and I remember, you know, right after Newtown, emotions are high, and I understand that, but we have to look at this from a very pragmatic, practical standpoint. simply eliminating assault rifles will not end mass killings, because it's self-loading, great, but if a guy walks in somewhere with a pump-action shotgun, he can kill just as many, if not more, people. If somebody walks in with a bunch of revolvers or a bunch of low-capacity magazines, or even, and this is an example that got no play in the American press, but I read it was in the Chinese People's Daily, which, you know, is a propaganda news outlet for the Chinese government, but it reported on a domestic story. There was a stabbing in a Chinese elementary school where a man went in and stabbed 20 children with a knife. So the problem I think we got to look at here is not as much the assault weapons. It's not as much the, self-loading. The problem seems to me to be much deeper, because you start to head down a slippery road when you say, well, we got to outlaw all assault weapons because they're being misused.
What is an assault weapon? Does that include a shotgun that people use for hunting, many of which are self-loading?
Technically, or
a semi-automatic, a pistol. And I think there's a confusion in a lot of people's minds between the difference between an automatic and a semi-automatic. And they think that a pistol that's self-loading is an automatic, but it's not. It's after each shot is fired, that's it. You have to pull the trigger again. Do we have a call, Shell?
No, I have a question.
Sure.
I've heard that sometimes gun dealers at those shows will tell the buyer how to make something into an automatic, how to take out a plate and do some filing, or is that possible?
Well, technically, any weapon can be made into a fully automatic weapon. I mean, any rifle can, ultimately, with the right amount of modifications. But the moment somebody does that, it becomes an illegal firearm. And that is, people know how to do it. You can find that out on the web. But just like manufacturing bombs in your home, the moment you do that to a firearm, it becomes illegal. So if you go to a shooting range and you pull the trigger and it just goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that now becomes an illegal weapon because it's now fully automatic. And in the vast majority of states, fully automatic weapons are illegal. But to be honest, I mean, I've had experience firing many, many, many weapons in my time, firing anything other than semi-auto, you're lucky to hit the broadside of a barn. It's just, you go everywhere.
Oh, you mean if you're firing at an automatic, more than one shot at a time?
More than one shot.
Because the recoil is...
The recoil, and it's the thing is, and this is what a lot of people who don't own firearms don't know, because again, they've never shot them before. When people watch movies, because movies, in my opinion, are the most misleading thing on the planet. It makes you think the CIA is omnipotent, and it makes you think that you can stand there from the hip and fire a fully automatic in a straight line. It's impossible. I have a lot of experience. I've fired a lot of military-grade weapons. I fired on burst, and I can tell you, on burst, it's hard to hit the broadside of a barn at 25 feet away. And the reason is because every time a bullet exits the barrel, your rifle barrel goes up. If you're a big guy and you're really cranking down on that weapon, you have it really locked into you, it might go up an eighth of an inch. But an eighth of an inch, as it passes over a distance, becomes higher and higher and higher, because if you imagine, it fires like an arc.
Sure.
So it starts off as an eighth of an inch coming out of the barrel. By the time you get 50 feet away, is now, 4 or 5 inches up. So now if you multiply that for three rounds, and each round is another eighth of an inch above the other, you're now going up. The third shot might be 3 feet above the target. So if you're talking about firing it on burst, fully auto, there's the same problem. There are incidences of gang-related shootings where the members fired 250 rounds of ammunition, didn't hit a darn thing. That's another point I'd like to make, too, is that the people who are using fully automatic weapons, the people who are shooting each other with them, are not law-abiding gun owners. This is a very important point I'd like to make. They are gangs. They are gangs like, what were they, Four Corner Hustlers? They're gangs like the Bloods and the Crips. They're gangs like MS-13 and Los Zetas. They're the ones who are out there with the heavy, intense firepower. They're not going out there and buying a Bushmaster assault rifle. They're going out there and they're illegally buying military-grade weapons that are legitimately military-grade weapons.
Right, right.
And I think one of the directions in which we're going off in one of the wrong directions, when you look at countries where gun ownership is completely outlawed, utterly outlawed, nobody owns guns. I got into an argument with a friend of mine. It was a friendly argument. He's a very good friend of mine living in the United Kingdom. But he said, in Britain, we have less gun violence than the United States. Nobody owns guns, less gun violence. And sometimes I feel like I'm the only person that remembers the Troubles. I mean, I lived in Ireland at the tail end of the Troubles during the Good Friday Agreement and everything, and I remember the IRA, and the IRA still, the Irish Republican Army, they had guns. The Ulster Volunteer Force, one of the loyalist paramilitaries, had guns. The Ulster Defense Association, the Ulster Freedom Fighters, all these guys still had guns. The average person in Northern Ireland and in Britain didn't own a gun, but who were the majority of the victims of the mass shootings and the mass bombings perpetrated by these terrorist organizations? They were ordinary people who did not own guns.
Right.
And
right.
So one of the things I think we have to look at when we look at the gun control issue is look at it from a practical social standpoint. Why are we having the gun violence? It's not the guns that's causing the violence. There is something socially wrong. In the case of Northern Ireland, it's civil unrest, and that's what's killing people. Not the guns, because the guns are illegal. It's the fact that there's civil unrest. In the case of the United States, that I'm not as certain of. Maybe it's the fact that a lot of kids are very heavily medicated. Maybe it's the fact that we tend to ignore psychological conditions, or we're afraid to talk about it.
Well, Representative Camilla did talk about the importance of the mental health aspect. And if you just joined our conversation, you're listening to In Context, and you're welcome to join us our discussion. We're talking about gun control at the moment. We were kicked off by a discussion with Representative Fred Camillo about a number of important issues, gun control being a particularly important issue, which is facing Connecticut's General Assembly this year. And to join the conversation, just call 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. And whatever your view is on gun control or these other issues, we'd be very pleased to hear your opinion. Marshawn, can I just like to take staying with gun control, but reorienting it slightly? I'd just like to throw out this, that there are approximately, according to the Congressional Research Service, 310 million firearms in the United States. 310 million firearms in the United States. And of those, about 114 million are handguns, 110 million are rifles, and 86 million are shotguns. And we don't know how many are assault rifles. There could be a couple million AR-15s. Is this an important part of our national defense?
Absolutely, absolutely. To be honest, what prevents an invasion of a country? Well, if you look at one of my favorite examples is you look at Switzerland, you know, and I love to give Switzerland as an example because Switzerland's a country that's pledged to neutrality. Now, neutrality is a very dangerous position to take because, especially during World War II, you know, to be neutral, you had to actually be able to defend yourself. Neutrality didn't guarantee that you were going to be out of the war. I mean, Luxembourg got invaded and they were neutral. The biggest thing that ensured Switzerland and has continued to ensure Switzerland's neutrality is the fact that it's very heavily armed. Its populace are all trained. They have national conscription. So you're not just giving guns to people. These are people who actually know how to use them.
Yeah, they have them in their homes. They get issued them as they're part of like permanent militia and they take
exactly.
it home. And everybody's got an assault weapon in his house.
Exactly. Yeah. It reduces crime.
And nobody invades Switzerland.
It reduces crime and the threat of invasion. I mean, one of the things I think is interesting is if you look at gangs, and gangs for me are very of particular interest because they are almost like a guerrilla army. When you look at the gang problem in the United States, where did the gangs like MS-13? MS-13 is one of the most brutal. I mean, these are the people who disembowel people. I mean, this is like they are brutal, and they do this in the United States. Where do they go when they want to invade homes? They do it in Lexington, Virginia. Wealthy middle class neighborhood. Why? Because nobody owns guns there. I mean, this is just looking at from a very rational standpoint. I don't want people to misconstrue me as being, you know, just rah 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 anything for our guns. But I'm looking at this as a historian from a historical context and as somebody who's I at least like to think an expert in military affairs. If you're going to invade a country, if you are going to rob somebody's home, you are going to do it with people who can't defend themselves. Why is it when we invaded Iraq, which make no mistake, Iraq was a modern country when we invaded.
Yeah.
You know, it was as modern as the United States. And I've traveled a lot in the Middle East, too. So I'm speaking from experience on this in many ways. When you look at before the invasion, Iraq, what made it so hard for us in the post-Saddam years, why they were able to resist the U.S. invasion was because they were armed. Now, you contrast that with the German invasion of France or Poland.
You can hold that thought one second. I think we may have a phone call. Do we have a phone call, Shell?
Yes, we do.
And who's on the air?
Excuse me, sorry.
This is Jim from Ansonia.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling in. Right in contact. Oops. We'll get him back. Hello, Jim. I can hear Jim, but maybe we just have a slight... Could you hold on there, Jim? You're fine now, Jim.
Oh,
you're
okay.
Calling from Ansonia. Thanks for calling in. Do you have a viewpoint on what we've been discussing on gun control?
Yeah, I do. I've been a lifelong shooter. My son is 14 and better trained and safer than half the adults out there, which I think is very important, is proper training. Matter of fact, he won a national skeet competition this year. So he's, well practiced. And one of the sad things is the gun club we belong to allows the local police forces to shoot there and certify there. And there's always one or two people from the club who have to watch the range and clean up when they're done and the like. And the sad thing is my 14-year-old shoots better than the vast majority of these police officers.
Yeah, I think Marshawn had, Jimmy, it's interesting you brought that up. Marshawn had alluded to that earlier. I guess they don't practice that often, right, Marshawn?
Well, when I was a child, I used to go to the gun club every Friday night and shoot with my parents. And what's interesting, just like you're talking about with your 14-year-old, and what's interesting is that in my recent research, I studied criminal justice in college along with history, and what shocked me to discover was that police officers in most towns are required to qualify only once a year with their weapon. The exception is very few police departments require them to qualify twice a year. The military is required to qualify once every 6 months, roughly. Twice a fiscal year, in theory. But it's the fact is that, like you're saying, your 14-year-old is actually more experienced with a firearm and more readily shoots regularly, I should say, regularly shoots than your average police officer and your average soldier.
Jim, do you see your gun as an important part of your home defense? Is it just purely recreational? You like to go to the gun club? I mean, how do you see that fitting into your life?
I look at it as, I enjoy shooting, target shooting, skeet shooting. I enjoy hunting. And I have a background in a former life. I worked on a security team. And so I also look at my guns as a home defense if, heaven forbid, I had to.
Are there changes in the current gun laws in Connecticut that you would feel comfortable with that you think would be prudent to help make people more safe and at the same time not impede on your gun rights?
I believe everybody before they buy a gun should have to be trained. I have no problem in a background check on buying ammunition because, unfortunately, when that happens, it's just going to create a whole other criminal enterprise in illegal ammunition for, the local drug dealer and gang.
Right,
it'll
become a black market, yeah.
Right, it'll create another multi-million-dollar black market for criminals. But I do feel that people should be trained, even if they're buying a gun for home defense. They should have some training.
Right.
Absolutely.
Because it's more dangerous to themselves if they don't know how to use it and if they don't have the mindset to use it without thought and question.
Absolutely. I definitely think one of the things that makes Switzerland so formidable is the fact that because they have national conscription, everybody is trained to use a weapon. And I think to a great extent, because of our history and our constitutional right to have local militias like volunteers, I think one thing that would actually make a lot of sense is if you had a sort of local militia, like your volunteer fire department kind of thing, maybe associated with your local gun club.
That's an interesting idea.
And when you went and you bought an assault rifle, you would be required to have a membership here. So this way you'd be required to, let's say, once a week, or let's face it, even once a month, go and shoot with your weapon or go and take a class, and they'd offer a group. I mean, it'd be like being a volunteer fireman. The idea, though, is that this way you would now be trained with your weapon. You know, you'd be guaranteed there'd be somebody who would say, I recommend this individual as being safe with their weapon. And then in the event of an emergency, an invasion or lawlessness, you have a group of people who are not only trained with their weapons, but that the police can deputize because they've all had background checks as well.
Jim, thank you very much for calling in. We only have about 8 minutes left in our show, so I want to give some other people a chance to get on the air. But thank you so much for calling us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Well, you know, that is a very good point. If you want to join the conversation, the phone number here is 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. We're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. WPKN's 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. And we're a live public affairs call-in show. We've been talking about important state issues and most recently about gun control. And the call-in number again is 203-336-9756. And our previous caller, Jim, just mentioned the importance of gun training. And in fact, you can't get a license to own a handgun in Connecticut unless you've taken an NRA-approved course, right?
Well, that's why, I mean, I think to be honest, when you look at the problem of, you know, these shootings and whatnot, and, you know, I think we have to look at this from a practical, pragmatic standpoint. Simply attacking guns and saying, we're going to outlaw firearms is like if you live on top of a gas main and it keeps exploding, instead of trying to figure out, you know, you ban matches to solve the problem of the exploding gas main. You know, it's kind of like that. We're attacking the symptom, not the problem.
Well, we're talking to a nation with 310 million guns. It's obviously a very important part of our culture. So, and depends on the part of your country you're in. I know I live in a very heavily settled suburb, and I think that people are not as comfortable there, are not comfortable in Manhattan as they would be in a remote rural location. Do we have another caller, Shel?
Yes, we do. We have Bowen from Winchester Center.
Winchester Center. What's the first name again there?
Bowen.
Bowen. Okay.
Bowen. Go ahead, Bowen.
Thanks,
you're on the
Bowen.
Air.
You're on the air.
Yeah, it's Bowen with a B.
Okay. Now, thank you for calling, Bowen. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I'm real glad to hear you guys are out there. You don't hear this kind of conversation anywhere else, period.
Thank you.
And I'm real good to hear some of the points that Marchand's made, especially the point that the Bushmaster AR-15 type of semi-auto is really a faux assault weapon. It really is not an assault weapon. It's a semi-auto. I had a J.C. Higgins when I was 12, 13 years old, semi-auto, and something that I found out from an honest gun enthusiast was that I could fire that faster than an AR-15. just because of the length of the bullet and the way the mechanism works, I could actually do it. And I was in Vietnam, and I fired some 16s. And generally, yeah, you do. You fire one, two, three shots at a time, and that's it. And I was actually the armorer in my company and had to take the whole company out to the firing range, you know, because we were an airport company. We didn't do bush work, and we had to fire up stuff. And it was amazing how many of the targets came out just as clean as they were put up. And it wasn't a very long shot.
One of the issues mentioned by Representative Camilla, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get your take on it, was that there's no need to have clips that hold 30 rounds, and that maybe we should reconsider civilians need that.
Here's a point, and this is human nature. This is an observation I've made over I'm 65. I've made it over 100,000 years. Most people that have guns and they go to the shooting range and they go out and they do this and that, you know, it's like fishing. They don't do it for the purpose even of hunting. They do it to have fun. And this is how I like to fault the NRA on this, is they're missing the entire point. I've heard in the past the argument that, well, you need this because, you know, there are hunters out there and they've got to get off this many shots, which is garbage. And the idea is that when you pull a trigger 10 times, you get 10 shots. It's like the 4th of July. it's fun to do. It's fun to target practice. It's fun to compete with your shots. It's fun to be the best shot or to try to be. And that's what people have got guns for. I mean, in, to a large degree. I mean, it's becoming more and more about, for the purpose of protection, and that's a little scary because there's a lot of folks that do not know how to use them, and they get a purse gun or a pocket gun, and that's very scary because they, like the cops, they don't practice, they don't know how to use them. The other thing is, and this is a point that, that I need to bring up because it's, I've seen it. I'm in the Nation Builders chat group. The idea of the militia and the way it's been couched as the militia is or is not.
Oh.
Man argument. It is not the argument. In the second. Are you there?
Yes, we're there. Yeah, go
okay.
ahead.
Okay, in the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms with the militia, that's an example of why we need guns, all right? In English common law, you did not need anybody's authority to defend yourself. That was absolutely accepted as law. There was English common law when this thing got put in. At the time, the revolution and all that, there's no question that the reason people... put that into the Constitution was to protect from an oppressive government, which is what exactly what we did in the
well, this is, you know, yeah.
So
yeah.
Here's what it gets down to: the words in the second part Second Amendment are what is important because they trump every other thing in the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Infringed is the word that you have to look at. The dictionary guy was an old man, but he was contemporary with these people, and he put together that whole assembly of words at that time. The word infringed is used as it is written in the dictionary. It means you don't hang anything on it. You don't amend it. You don't fold, bend, staple, or mutilate. This is what the word means, and this is where the argument needs to be, not the faux argument and the manipulated argument
militia. Let me just ask you this, Bowen.
Yes.
Do you think that it's important that the average citizen have guns as a check upon the possible tyranny of its own government?
Yes. There's never been a government in the history of the world that has not eventually, at some point in its history, oppressed its citizens. And that's why... that was written in the Constitution in the first place, because I mean, of course, it's human nature, and it was a current theme. This is exactly what had just been going on, and what was going on. This was the reason for that amendment, to make sure that people understood that they needed to protect themselves not only from an invader, which they had absolute right to as human beings in the first place, but from a government that would not only oppress them slowly over time, but would oppress them with a possible superiority because of its structure.
Bowen, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there because
right.
we're coming
good
to the end
me.
Of our show. But
thank you so much
for calling, Bowen.
You betcha.
And we've been talking about gun control. This is WPKN's In Context Live Public Affairs Call-In Show on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Marshawn McDermott Rowe. Behind the board is Shel Tarrant. Do you have one final thought before we go off the air and go to our PSAs?
One final thought, and that's, you know, the mistake of history. What causes history to repeat itself is people forget their history. And certainly with the issue of having guns to protect you from your own government, I mean, the first thing the Romans did to the Visigoths was take their sword, or Romans did to the Vandals, I'm sorry, the Vandals, when the Vandals came in as refugees, was take all their swords. And they had to sneak their swords, and then you had a revolution, and then they sacked Rome.
Hopefully the barbarians are not at the gates, but you got to be ready, right?
Well, you got to be ready.
Well, we have to get off the air because we have not only our PSA, but coming up next is Bob Lasbrigato, who will be coming up with the jazz as soon as the PSA is over. And yes, one more comment.
Oh, no, I was just going to say he's filling in for
Rick Patron, who's usually here giving our jazz sounds. So we'll see you next week. Take care.